Hey everyone, before we kick this episode off, I urge everyone listening to like and subscribe to our podcast, wherever you may get your podcast from. So if you listen to us on iTunes, please give us a 5-star rating, or also subscribe to us on Spotify. And I urge all of our listeners to head to our website, and you can get more than just our podcast from there. We have news stories all the time there. We have feature articles there. So head to tnpmedia.au. That's tnpmedia.au. All right, without further ado, we'll get stuck into the podcast.
Talk and Power, your motorsport and motoring radio show. Now on 88.5 FM, the Valley comes alive. And podcasting across iTunes and talkandpower.com.au.
All right, welcome to the Talk and Power podcast. This is episode 184. Who can believe it's episode 184? I'm here with our co-host, Johnny Alardi, to my right, and Simon Gonzo Travellini to my left over there. If you're watching, if you're listening to this podcast, I urge you to go back and watch it as well. We have a very special guest in the studio, Michelle Morrison. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I do believe that congratulations are in order.
Yes, thank you very much. Wanted to have only positive things to be talking about for this episode.
So you went out and won the event just 2 days ago. As we're recording, this is 2 days after the Nitro Slam at the Perth Motorplex. Talk us through that win anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Really fortunate on Saturday to take out the win. You know, I think I've got to be straightforward and say I definitely had luck on my side. Yeah. You know, my contenders that I was up against for our Chicago shootout rounds, every round I'd actually won on the start line. So, but
that's not luck, that's skill.
Well, you know, and that's the thing. I feel like you don't have that bragging right until you explain what it means to you and how you view it. And for me, my qualifying passes were really strong. My reaction times were really great. And all in all, my car is just so consistent. So as much as the fate of those races are actually made on the line, I'm really proud of how I drove and how my car ran for the weekend.
So you should be, but isn't that drag racing, but is creating your luck?
Yeah, it is. And I guess it's just, you know, I'm still learning after being racing for so many years. Yeah. I'm still learning to give myself some credit, I suppose.
Yeah. Michelle, I think you should give yourself a lot of credit because ultimately you're the person that lets go of that button. And if you don't get that right, that's the end of the race.
Yeah, and just where it comes back to that is that with my car, how consistent it is this season, it is really all on me and that start line procedure. Mm. And, you know, my husband Trent picking my dial-ins, he's like a rain man when it comes to dialing racing. And I used to pick my own, and now he's just crunching numbers and looking at the data right up to before I go through the tunnel. So
yeah, it's the crew chief's job.
That's exactly what it
is.
Right.
Yeah, I just know how right he is. So it comes back to me.
How awesome was it racing Ian in the final? You know, after everything that they've been through as a family.
Paul Griffin in the final.
Oh,
yeah, Paul Griffin in the final. Look, it was very close. Ian missed out by 0.009 to be able to meet the final.
Wow, because the way the points looked, it looked as though Ian and you, right? Because you know, like I said before the show started, that we've got a bit of a lag on when we get the results. So yeah, I basically put that together off the points, but there you go.
It's very interesting you say that because how...
That's a bit of a malfunction there, Nick. Caught on video.
Well, we're on video, so do we stop?
We'll keep rolling.
Just pan the shot.
I forgot to plug the power in. I got Johnny to get it there, and I'll almost go and ask over there. Sorry.
I think you did, actually.
Yeah.
Until Johnny stopped
So much for it, not editing anything.
No, anyway.
All right. So you started off in junior dragster.
Yes. Started off racing in junior dragster, but was involved in drag racing for about a year or maybe two seasons before I actually started racing juniors myself. My dad used to sponsor a friend of his, Neil Barron, who raced in Top Comp. And I was always my dad's little TA at the time, and I was doing mechanics in high school and always had an interest in cars. And, I was doing some pit crew work on Neil's car, and his crew were teaching me quite a bit, but people could see us hanging around and were saying to my dad, like, why isn't she in the car and you're going to get her in juniors? And, just did three seasons in juniors.
Yep.
Can I ask what it is about juniors? Because there is something, we look at all other forms of motorsport and their junior categories, we'll call it karting, and it seems to be, not, I don't want to say the success rate isn't as high as what junior drag racing is. So if I look back at recent people that are successful in drag racing, all come from junior drags, and not many start off in sedan or super street. So it seems to be that junior drag racer seems to be a, for the lack of a better word, a breeding ground for competitive races later in life.
Yeah.
Are you able to elaborate on that, why that might be?
I think for me personally, for being in junior dragsters, you're learning about the fundamentals of drag racing, and you're learning about that start line procedure and, when it comes to group three, your dial-ins. Mm. So I think so much of that carries on throughout all the other groups of drag racing. And I said just on the weekend with my acceptance speech, it really comes down to, it's such a mental game as well. You can have a really good performing car, but if you aren't able to mentally compose yourself, it plays such a big deal in how your events are going to go and your success rate, your win rate. So I think junior dragster prepares you a lot for that. I think also, for me, starting in juniors, I was 15. So I started in 15, and I have to say I'm not particularly sure how they're running juniors at the moment. I know there's the three divisions for your time restrictions. When I was racing, there was two divisions. But the higher divisions could race the lower division. And for me, being 15, I could be paired up against an eight-year-old. And if you lose, there is no way that you can be sour, mad, angry when there's an eight-year-old that's just absolutely beaming. So it it teaches you how to be a good loser.
That's a lesson you should teach a few of the guys down there in Modified.
I've never actually considered that, to be honest with you. That's a really interesting insight to that, because I had never considered that.
To
you pointing that out.
Yeah. I think for me, when I was in juniors, there was a really strong friendship amongst us all as well. And, we used to have water fights, like in between rounds when we had big breaks. And so you are more on that friendship level. I'm not sure whether they're pushing more of a competitive nature amongst them now, or maybe it was pushed on some and just not on me.
It's parents.
Yeah, I think, I definitely didn't have that push from my dad. So
yeah. The kids are great. The parents.
The parents might miss out.
Well, talk us through then. I mean, I saw an Andrew interview you did some years ago, and I've always found it interesting. There does seem to be a pathway from junior dragster into modified. Why is it that the super street and the sedan and top sportsman doesn't really get the following from drag? I mean, Brody's probably a bad example of that, but I guess generally speaking, we see a shift to modified from junior drags. Why was that the case?
Yeah, look, Nick, I'm so glad you were able to ask me that question, because that interview, my edit got me on, I think, on the bad side of the super street and super sedan races, because it did edit it in a way that made it sound as if it wasn't worthy to go into those fields. They did crop out the big factor that myself and my dad always had our mindset on an altered.
Yeah.
We always had our mindset on the altered, being that that's what we loved with Neil Berendt's car. But then I really liked the fact that it didn't look like a street car, you know, and I wanted to be racing a car that looked mean, that looked tough. I loved the short wheelbase but with the open engine. And so for me, I'm going to be driving on the road at that stage, you know, buying a car to drive on the road. I don't want a car that then looks the same on the track. But that's for me personally. You know, I knew that that was the end goal for us, and also with the altered in particular, and I suppose with other dragsters like rails and your front engine dragsters, I suppose, depending on what strength of your chassis you have, there's ways to then step up and improve in that with that same chassis when you just switch out the engine or build on top of it.
It's got to be the toughest car to drive in drag racing. I've driven pretty much everything except for a dragster, and I don't think that there's anything that gets your attention as much as an altered. Like, from the let go of the button to every bump, every single bump in that track, you know exactly where it is, and then trying to pull it up at the end of the track. I got to tell you, you know, that is crazy to get out of a junior, and it must have taken some incredible mind power to overcome all of that. You know what I mean? It's just amazing that you made that transition.
Look, it was being 17, there were a lot of people speaking to my dad saying, "You're crazy for putting her in that."
Oh, really?
You know, they were saying, "You're crazy putting her in this car to come out with 632 cubic inches." My first full track pass in that car beat the national record for AMA. They were saying my dad was crazy. There was doubts on females being in the sport. I had some backlash for my age, for being female, from going straight from the juniors into that category. And I was a 17-year-old, you know. I wanted to prove them wrong. And
and you did.
Yeah. And so I actually did the Kenlow driving school in Queensland. I competed over there 2008 with my last 2008-2009 season, went over and finished off my junior dragster season, and then stuck around to do the Kenlow driving school. And his rail, I seem to remember it being like 940s. I think for that experience, because I wasn't new to drag racing, it just handling the car and having that kind of stepping stone for the speed was my benefit from doing that. But yeah, getting into the altered, it was from the start, I was like, this is tough. Like, so this is mean. This is angry.
Talk us through that first, like, the first time you let go of the button.
Yeah. So when I was doing the Kenlow driving school, you know, one of the things that I got taught was to sit your head back on the roll cage. You know, put your head back as far as you can. If your head's not back on the roll cage, when you take off, your head's going to go back. You'll think, oh, my head, you'll lose your focus. So my head's back on my roll cage when I've taken my thumb off the trans brake for the first launch pass. You know, you've got to do your licensing, so maybe 60 foot I would have to go or do a successful launch, and probably the burnout in itself. And I could not see a thing. Could not see a thing with the vibrations that was coming through my roll cage. And I have to say, my first season driving the altered, we actually leased it. So I had about 4 inches of camping foam actually behind my head, and 2 layers of that I was sitting on top of. Yeah. So to have that foam and to still feel the impact of that vibration coming through the roll cage. And so from then on, I've always sat my head off the roll cage, and only just recently actually started to put it back against it. But it, I just always thought, no, I can't see with the vibrations going through there, and But I had something to prove. So
did the punch in the back, did that get your attention? That initial hit the first time you let go?
Yeah, I think I just was waiting for my vision to clear.
Yep.
You know, it got up, it went, and my vision cleared. And I thought, well, let's bring it back a bit, you know. And by the time it cleared, I realised that I was pretty close to the wall, so let's just correct that a bit. But yeah, my car at that point, you know, my first pass in the car was my dad believes that it was a 7.
That's insane.
A 7:32 with a 4, and the reason I remember that is because 324 is Trent's race number. So
okay.
That's how I remember that. But the car went faster after that, and and it got angrier, and the faster it went, the more angrier those launches became, and the more tyre shake I'd have to handle and drive through, and yeah, it's always been very mean off the start.
It's an interesting start. So that's a very interesting thing you just told us there that you shared with us, and that's quite insightful. But talk us through then, like, because your dad's you're under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Your dad's under pressure as well because people are saying probably not the right thing. So that's a lot of pressure here. All jokes aside. So how did you like? I mean, how influential? I know your father was. Even though he wasn't racing, he was pretty influential at the track as well, I do remember. So tell us how important he was in putting this all together and making sure that you were right and everyone else was wrong.
Yeah, I've got three sisters, you know, and I think by the time – I'm the second youngest. I think by the time my parents found out they were having a fourth girl, my dad was like, okay, take away the Barbies, give her the spanners, you know. My dad always was like the biggest advocate for me as a female, as a girl, that I am on equal playing level.
Mm.
And he always has such – he's always got such big support of me, such great support of me. And – I think just his confidence in me made me – just gave me that reassurance. But my dad worked so hard. Mm. He worked so hard, and I never really knew my dad growing up to have a hobby, to have an interest. He was always just working.
Mm.
And he worked away. He worked away for long stints at a time, and I grew my relationship with my dad was so close because I adapted to his interests. I grew to love his interests, but because drag racing was his hobby and then became mine, his main goal was just that we were having fun.
Mm.
And so I never felt any pressure from my dad.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I do think that at the time, I think my dad was doing that with my best interest.
Mm.
I never felt any pressure for him. But my dad, he told me about, you know, 12 months ago that he had people approach him wanting to sponsor me, but he didn't want me to have that pressure, that external pressure.
Wow. Okay.
Where I feel as if it would have actually given me confidence, knowing that I had other people support really there to back me and to back me in that financial way and to be able to support and benefit in that way. I think it would have allowed me to actually have a bit more confidence. Mm.
So the family name Osborne, you bought your name Osborne and then you bought it together with the Morrisons, another very famous as well family name in drag racing. Simon and I remember your father-in-law, he was Trevor Morrison at Ravenswood, Mad Max.
Yeah.
That's a lot of the
war between the Morrisons and the Sheehans.
That's right.
A big thing back in those days. Yeah.
Yeah.
Double C altered wars.
In top comp at Ravenswood.
Yeah.
He did really well. So talk us through what it's like. I mean, your husband Trent now has taken taken. Well, he took over where his father kind of left off. He's not racing at the moment, but how?
He's got the current record though in double C Ultra.
He's still the record holder. I've got that here. 6.721. That's from a few years ago as well, but he's still the current record holder. So what's it like bringing the two families together? What's that like?
Yeah, well, I suppose because Trent started in modified, and so we raced. I started a little bit before him, I think just one season before he came on. But I actually had eyes for Trent when his dad, Trevor, would be versing Neil. And so they'd be pitted across, and I was like, and he doesn't even recall seeing me. And I'm like, I was right there. What are you talking about? But yeah, I remember pointing him out to my sister, and then once he started racing, you know, Trevor had finished racing for a while before Trent had started, and then yeah, we raced together for a season before we actually started dating. But we're very different races.
Yep.
We've got a very different mindset, and it's been last season. Last season was, I have to admit, you know, it was a challenge for us, and it was something that we had to talk about what my way is in comparison to his, and make sure that we had an understanding of each other's values and our what our goals are and what drag racing means to us and what it means to us and what we want to portray. And it's... The Morrison name has huge success. Mm. You know, it has huge success. And for Trent to have grown up watching his dad, and for Trevor to have so much success, and then for Trent to live up to that, where I say that I didn't have the pressure from my dad, I don't think Trent would have ever felt the... Well, I don't think the pressure would have ever been verbalised for Trevor. In fact, I know that it wouldn't have, but I know that Trent would have felt it, just knowing how. I shouldn't say any facts that I don't have completely clear. But there's not much room for error there on Trent's behalf if he wants to be as good as Trev. So,
yeah. No, and I get that too. I just remember Trevor. For whatever reason, for me, he sticks out at Ravenswood. When I was going to Ravenswood, he was very successful.
Very, very, very successful.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah, it was always at the pointy end, and that was the infancy of Top Comp as well, really. Top Comp was reasonably new back then. And, he'd always be going rounds in Top Comp. But I get that. I get what you're saying there. Yeah. I completely understand. Talking of pressure then, talk us through then. I want to know 2015. We'll talk about 2015 first, because it's the year you won the Australian Championship, the Modified Championship. Travelling, you've got to travel. You can't win a championship from just racing at the Motorplex.
Yeah,
so talk us through that 2015, what it was like, and the pressure.
The new tracks and getting accustomed to the time on the road.
Yeah, that's right. So I was really fortunate that I had been travelling over east and racing in Sydney and Queensland. We started that with juniors, and it was quite easy to take the cars across at that point, but there was quite a few that were travelling. And just that time being on the road, my dad's concreting business would have an accommodation bus when they were working in remote areas that didn't have any accommodation. And so, like, even just driving across and having those the bus trips, and there would be a convoy of other racers all going with us, it was a great experience in itself. So I can't recall, but I'm sure that I'm quite certain that I would have been travelling even if I didn't take out the win for the Westerns. It kind of just solidified it, I suppose, that I was going to have a strong chance. Also, for that year, Adelaide International Raceway was running, which it wasn't in the years prior, at least not in a spot where we would be, I suppose, either sacrificing the Perth Motorplex season to then make it for that one. And all of my relatives are in Adelaide. So to be able to race there at a track that my dad raced growing up, you know, just in street cars, but nonetheless, being able to have my relatives come out, like, that was really great. Took out the runner-up took out the runner-up position for that event, and that kind of left me in a really high position, I think maybe even a points cap, because you would also get the travel bonus, which that I think that just helped me reach that cap. And then once I even entered and qualified, went through rounds at Sydney and Queensland, it did come down to another racer being knocked out by Rob Harrington. He will never let me forget that. And I'm pretty sure I still owe him a carton of beer. But yeah, and it came down to quite a nail biter of watching, making sure that I was going to stay on top by someone else's less fortune.
So for those at home that don't understand how that works, we have we did, I don't know if we still do.
No, they don't anymore.
They don't anymore. Yeah, we had a 200, I think it was 200 points maximum.
I think 300. Yeah, 300 cap.
And then once you reach that maximum, the Winter Nationals was where it was decided. Yeah. So it would come down to that last race, and you'd often see two or three people that were at the 300 points. But then I've seen people that went there with the maximum points and still didn't win the championships.
Well, yeah, and that's right. And because I think for being on the East Coast, you know, they've got those smaller tracks as well that they're really able to quite easily get to and be able to travel and you know, actually partake in a few more rounds than what is achievable for us over here, especially at the expense of then
we have to travel.
Yeah, and then you're almost giving up your Perth season to be able to go national, and you want to make sure that you're in a good position to be able to do that.
Yep. So I want to take a step back 4 years earlier, because that's a really interesting year as well, 2011. You get to the Winter Nationals. You're in fourth spot, I think, from my research. Another lady who's also vying for the championship, we know her as Kelly Betts.
Yeah.
Kelly Corbett, I think her name was back then. Talk us through that. Either of yous don't win the championship, but talk us through, because there was a lot of focus. I remember this distinctly, 2011. There was a lot of focus on the fact that there was two females vying for the modified championship in Australia. And I think it even made national news.
Yeah, yeah. There was a Channel 9 feature.
Yeah, on Today Show?
Yeah, yes. The morning program, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So talk us through that, like 2011, because as you just said before, you're kind of breaking new ground in 2009, 2010, getting into a modified. A year and a bit later, you're vying for the championship against another female. Talk us through that.
Yeah. You know, it's just always wanting to be the best advocate as you can be for female racing. And as much as you're in it for yourself, you're also being mindful that other people and other contenders can represent and bring that message across for the greater good for females being in the sport. I'd raced with Kelly previously in the previous years and at Sydney before that, and being in junior dragsters, had seen for her, I don't think we competed against each other in junior dragsters, but definitely knew the name. And it was great to be there and to be a part of it and to be able to be racing against Kelly. And, you know, she's been a huge advocate for female racing. But from the very start, you know, she's obviously had some great success and has really, you know, covered a lot of ground through drag racing categories, divisions. But, you know, also for the very start of her junior dragster days, I'm quite certain she was the first champion of junior dragsters to even exist. So, you know, she's always been a huge name in the sport.
Mm.
Do you find it frustrating that, you know, we're all about equality in the world now, and do you find it frustrating because we've had equality from the 60s? You know, with Shirley Muldoon.
Shirley. Yeah. Well, we've had equality since they invented this sport.
Yeah. And do you find it frustrating that we don't get the recognition and the sponsorship that we really should. You know, all the other sports are segregated. There's a male league and a female league. You don't see any women in Formula One. You hardly ever see women in NASCAR. But in drag racing, you know, the numbers aren't even, but when you look at the results are probably staggered towards the women.
Statistically, they probably are, yes.
Yeah, look, it's, I suppose, you know, for now in 2024, we've got to be mindful of what marketing the whole sport is getting. Mm. And I don't think it is necessarily about our females not getting the support now. Our whole support, drag racing sport in itself in Australia is really struggling, I feel, with that corporate support. But as a female, yes, I suppose, you know, when I was racing before my big break, but no, before my big time off, I always felt like I would have to target a sponsor that met my demographic, and I was like, okay, it was really important for me to have a pink car simply so I was representing female races. I wanted everyone to know that was a girl driving. So then I'm thinking, you know, do I have to get nappy sand's pink, like do I have to, that's that. And then I'm thinking, like, why have I actually have that tunnel vision of thinking of something that would be pink, something that would be for girls? It's like, well, no, this is, let's broaden this, yeah. And you really can appeal to anyone. But wasn't really willing to change the colour of the car because I'd rather represent females and have a pink car to do that. And it's not saying that you can't if you don't have a pink car, but when we've got spectators in the stands, that from a young age, and I know for myself, I would know the car by the colour. I would know the car by the sponsor. And, you know, I'm pretty ashamed to admit how long it took me to know that Robin Judd was the top door slammer driver and that his name wasn't William Buck. Because it was William Buck on the sponsorship, you know, on his car.
And you made my night.
Yeah.
But have we missed a trick there? Because I think in drag racing, Zap has stayed pretty much in the same scheme there, so he's easily identifiable. He has done the Zap's Rat thing for years, so he markets that and he markets it well. Yourself with the pink car, me personally, I think I don't think it'd be wise changing the colour now because your journey in that car has always been pink. But I think we need to do more of that in terms of marketing the sport is to identify the cars so that we know that your car is going to be a pink car. You know, I'm not a big – I don't like I love V8 supercars, sorry, but I don't like this continual round after round. The car looks completely different from one race to another. And I don't think that does the sport any help. It needs to the car needs to be identifiable. So in John Zappia's case, it's Zapp's Rat. In your case, it's the pink car. But if it had a name, like we were just talking about before, Trevor Morrison.
Yeah.
The first thing you said, Mad Max.
Mad Max.
Yeah. We identify, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I suppose with Trevor, you know, that name he carried on, and then Trent took on that name himself. But I suppose it's what it means to you, and the cars being easily identified and being able to continue that on. Like you said, for John Zappia, his car has had the same design, has had the same structure in its design, no matter what of who his sponsors are, it still fit that design. Where I suppose when you say the V8 supercars and when they're coming to you with the money that then they have to support that, would you change the colour? For me personally, it would take a lot. It's hard to say because...
So when Red Bull comes knocking...
How many zeros?
When Red Bull comes knocking, you know...
Monster? Was that Black?
Yeah, Monster, I'd say... You know, Monster's a huge sponsor of drag racing across Ireland, across the NHRA. And, you know, Shane Tucker obviously had Monster here in Australia. But for their Irish driver, which I'm not going to attempt the name. I can't pronounce the name, and I do apologise. I should have researched this because I how to pronounce. But you know, sponsoring Brittany Force as well, and they wants to have a pink drink. They've got a pink can. Why not have the pink car? It's that. Yeah, I feel like that's a missed opportunity, and it's a missed opportunity for then to then represent the females in the sport.
100%.
Listen, going back, you know, you were saying how you know we don't have that corporate, you know, impact because of the female. You know, do you think they don't care? Not that they don't care, but they feel that because there isn't a female driver, say in NASCAR or F1, then the corporates are going, "Oh, this is an opportunity to." You know, jump on it and make that we're doing this for a female to enter the sport, whereas in drag racing, they don't need that because it's already there.
I don't know, but what
it's a good question. I don't know either.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I always, you know, fall back to when I start thinking about this is that if you're, you know, let's not forget that most of these corporates are run by men. Right, there are some that are run by women, but the reality is that most of them are. And I think the reality that women can kick men's asses really hurts them, and that's why they don't support it. That's what I believe, because you look at all the other sports and, you know, they really segregate that, whereas we've never done that. You want to race us, you come in. Doesn't matter what colour, sex, whatever. And, you know, and women have been really successful. I mean, Kelly Betts, Australian top fuel champion, you know. So, I think it really is that they're trying, honestly, by not sponsoring women in drag racing and by not making a big deal, by not having these big corporates, you know, that sell, you know, products that you know, relate to everything, by them not engaging and not putting money towards making people like yourself or Kelly more famous, I think it's just a reflection of the fact that they're scared.
Yeah, I think also, and for me being in the position, I felt like I always got attention because of my appearance. I felt like, you know, being female, being young, but then also I would do my hair and makeup for the drags. And, you know, at that age I had pressures from society that then I felt I had insecurities as a late teenager, young 20-year-old that I wanted to uphold. I always got that initial attention from people in the sport, and whether that be spectators, whether it be people in the corporate section, I always felt that I might have got that from my appearance. But then being able to talk the talk, I then earned their respect. And it's not that they wouldn't have given me their respect anyway, but I feel as if to maybe open some of these doors for more corporate sponsorship, they want to make sure that the females know what they're talking about. And unfortunately, I think they assume, or the majority would assume, that maybe they don't.
Yeah, that's tragic. Look, ultimately, like I said before, you need to let go of that button.
Yeah.
Right? And the other thing is, of the most difficult cars to win a modified championship in, an altered is by far.
It would have been far easier to drag stuff.
And
that's drag, for sure.
I know. And then you get this thing that's got a short wheelbase, is really a fairly rigid chassis, and you put a 632 in it. You know, that's just crazy.
It's great to see that I'm amongst the right people, because, you know, the modified versus, the T-bucket versus dragster debate is something that it seems to the fight's always out on which is better, and it's just no question.
I'll tell you what, I know which one's more exciting to drive. That's for sure.
I should probably walk
I'll have to take your word for it, because
I should probably walk that statement back a bit. I reckon we're going to get some letters of complaints about my commentary about it would have been far easier in a dragster.
Uh-oh.
Paul's a Paul listener, Gubbly. Yeah, he's probably
exactly what I was
sat right here, actually, Paul.
I was shocked to see the results and Paul's name wasn't in the final.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You mentioned just briefly before you took a break, the big break. It was 7 years all up, is that right?
Yeah, it was over seven, nearly coming up to eight, yep.
It was a big break from racing.
Sorry,
but it's,
I got to ask, having been through this just recently and not enjoying it at all, that first time you let go of the button after you got back in the car, talk me through that because it rattled me to the point where I don't know if I want to race anymore.
It's quite interesting how it works because when I raced before having time off, I raced a few years without a delay box, and then we brought the delay box on, and then when I went back for that first pass, my muscle memory just went back to no delay box, and I knew, okay, you know, release the trans brake first amber, release the trans brake first amber, and then suddenly I was like, oh yeah, wait, and then you're almost like, okay. The light's green. You're sitting there. You can see it green, and then you're like, I guess I'm just going to take off when the delay box kicks in. But you're like, oh, so you're not really like set ready to go. It's going to know when it's going to take off because you see that green come on, or you see all your ambers come on. So I'm like, oh, all right, I'll just slowly wait for these lights to go down, and the car will just go when it goes.
And what was it like when it finally released?
Yeah, it was really good to be able to get the thrill racing in the altered again, because I do think that I got too comfortable in it before. You know, I got too comfortable. I was ready for something new. I wanted to be going faster. I wanted to have a change. It was all I knew for, you know, six or seven years. And I was getting too relaxed, too comfortable, and being back in it again after having so long off, I love it. I love it. So.
But you talk about taking time off, but it wasn't really time off, was it? I mean, it was time off from drag racing, but you had two girls.
Two girls,
so
yeah.
So that's a major, I mean, we've all had kids here, so we've all had two kids. And that's not time off, really, is it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually the opposite. It's the opposite.
I thought that's what Gonzo was going to ask. Yeah, how do you raise these kids?
No, it's that, you know, because like I said, when I got back in the car, I didn't like it at all. I need to get in something slow and work my way up. And I don't know how you did it. It's amazing. It blows my mind. And then, you know, you're in the winner's circle, like,
Maybe because her kids are a bit older. So maybe when your kids are a bit older, you'll jump straight in like she did.
I doubt it. They're roughly the same age,
older?
I think.
Yeah, I think they're roughly the same age.
Yeah.
3.5 and 5.
Oh, maybe. Oh,
yeah.
Almost.
Very similar.
Yeah, 4.5 and 6.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So mine are the younger ones. So maybe that's.
So no excuses, Gons.
Yeah.
No, I'm just old. She's a lot younger than me. That's all it is.
But talk us through that part. In that 7 years, you have had two children, two beautiful girls.
Yep.
What's it like having Luna and Claire? What's it like having them at the track with you?
Yeah, it's been a huge part of the reason why I'm back.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose at first when I stopped racing, it was actually just – it wasn't intended on being for so long. I had to do – maintenance to the engine after winning the championship, and it was going to be pretty tight to get some parts from the States before our Perth season would start. Then we had the Motorplex was in quite disarray after the Miosevic's didn't renew the lease. It was a bit of a, is the government going to take over the lease, run the lease? Is anyone, are we going to have a season? So we thought, let's just wait for the dust to settle, and the sport didn't improve, and the sport went backwards for quite a few years here in Perth in particular. Soon after that, we were engaged, married, with then two kids to follow. But because we were able to, Trent was still racing in top comp, and he wouldn't race the whole season, but they'd pick and choose which events they were going to compete in. We were still able to be a part of it. I was still able to be down at the track, and it seemed, for me, while we were, while the girls were young, while we weren't financially supporting the racing, we're very fortunate that Trent drives his dad's car. And so for me, it comes down to the priorities of where our finances go and for where our time goes. And to do that just so I could race, where really at that point, while the girls were so young, it really would have had to be one or the other, I would say. But it was also, you know, I wanted to make sure when I was back that I was going to be back. Obviously, expanding your family and pregnancies and then your recovery time after that, I didn't want to come back for half a season or a season and then be out again. And so just make sure that when I was back, I'd be staying. And I really had to kind of switch my mind off for while I had the time away, because it was really hard not to be racing and to kind of to put that at the back of my mind. But ultimately it came down to Trent was crewing on his friend, well, the friends with the Priolos and in sprint car racing, and I take the girls down to watch, and they were starting to become really strong Speedway fans, and I was like, "Well, let's bring it back on the other side." And it got to a point where the girls really understood, and the girls had such a strong interest, and I've never believed anything more than the saying when they say, "Yeah, it's like it's in their blood," you know, it's in their blood, and having you know, two drag racing parents and drag racing granddad, you know, it's just they love it, and for me, they're at the track from the start of the day till the end of the night. It is a long day, and they're often asleep in the tow car for the last two or three rounds, and I always say, you know, for drag races or for, you know, for people that race or maybe have families that have brought up through the racing, they would love it. They'd be like, "Oh, look at, like, while I'm on track doing my burnout, oh, look through the window, you know, the two girls are asleep in their car seats in the tow car right next to it." But then there would be some spectators, I'm sure, that are saying, like, "You terrible mum, get your kids to home into a comfy bed,"
wrong,
you know?
They're wrong.
No place you could be, mate, I reckon.
I was just about to say exactly the same thing. Well, what better environment could they grow up in?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's so great. And seeing their involvement actually with the car, their interest there, it's, they're not forced to come to the racing. And if I was to have someone take them home before the night ends, that would just, I know that they would just be kicking and screaming. So they love it. You know, Cleo, my 3.5-year-old, she always, like, takes out the spark plugs, and she loves grabbing the tools. And she gets in the car seat, gets in the driver's seat, and she gets hold of the steering wheel, and she's going left, right, left. I'm like, "Well, just keep it straight. You know, we're going to make sure you know that this is going to be a straight line for you." And they've already picked out their colours for their junior dragsters, and it's definitely something that they'll be counting down the years for.
Yeah, that's, I was going to ask. Obviously, juniors are in the...
Yeah, definitely. There's no doubt about it, you know. But, you know, the girls are only 18 months apart, so we'll probably just try and get a discount for multiple buyers, I think.
Fair enough.
Let me know when you're going, because we might get four at the same time.
That's not a bad idea.
A shipping container over from the US. I'm hoping by that point, you know, we'll have the junior funny cars that can come over to Australia, because, you know, they've got the junior funny cars over in America, and maybe we could get like a miniature altered fiberglass body to sit on top of it.
I'm sure if you spoke with the cat of artists as well, they'd be on board too.
Ella, their 5-year-old, I've heard she's already got one. So
there you go.
She's already got one. She's got 5 years to go, but
Gordon said he wants to start racing. Maybe you got to go back there if you want to build your way up. You said you got to start somewhere slow, and be, you know, you might need to get back into one.
They've changed the I think the state government brought in the 10 now. So you got to be over 10, so it's still a ways off, which devastates me, because go-kart racing, Nicholas can start now, or motocross even.
I think the hardest part about that, you know, I shouldn't say hardest, but it's only WA. For the other states, it's still 8. It's hard, because it almost makes me feel as if do we start her in something else first? You know, for Luna, she's going to be 6 in January. And I'm like, should we go go-karting for a bit? But then what if the
That's exactly where I'm at. I've spoken to my eldest about it on several occasions, and he wants to go drag racing because daddy goes drag racing. He's not interested in the go-karts. And it's like, well, you can't do it till you're 10. And it's, you know, it's a state thing. It's not,
It is. And I'm not sure whether they'll ever look back on that or
they can go to Victoria and race.
Yep.
Yeah.
But they can't race here.
Yeah.
It's a bit like our gun laws at the moment.
I don't want to categorise you, but we were talking about it a little bit earlier, but you seem to represent what I call it the second generation of drag races in WA. The sport is, even though it's relatively old, it's not that old that I don't, maybe there are a couple of third generations, but you represent the second generation. When I say second generation, when I look back at Ravenswood, organisations like Westside, WASMA, and when I put you in the same sort of category as Alicia Adamos, Alicia, that's not a surname anymore. Sorry, Alicia. Sam Treasure, Trent as well, of course. I mean, and I've probably forgotten a heap of them as well, but do you reckon, like, that changing of the guard for me kind of happened, maybe because I'm older, but it kind of happened overnight. We went from watching Trevor and, you know, growing up with the Adamoses, now their kids are racing.
Yeah.
Did that happen overnight, or was it just, obviously it didn't, but it just feels like it happened. We've got this new generation coming in, and I'm not aware of a third generation. There could be, but
Marchants.
Yeah, Marchants, yeah, probably. But there's a lot more in the second generation. It's interesting. Do you feel like you represent the second generation?
Yeah, I suppose. Although, like, my dad didn't race, you know, I've definitely been surrounded by a lot in in modified, in particular, and even when I was doing juniors, that whose parents were racing too, and it definitely is such a big sport for that kind of, as you said, passing of the guard like that.
Yeah.
Okay, on to the next one, and I mean, some of them are even racing at the same time, but yeah, it's I really think that it's pivotal in the progress and ongoing of drag racing.
McClure's, did our father race? Is that my distant memory?
He had a I think Tim raced motorbikes.
But Tim had a Volvo as well. Like, this is going
you're right.
I don't know him in the burnout, but I know they used to do burnouts.
Yeah,
they're like, they were the kings with those Taranas at Motivation. At Burswood.
I don't remember.
The McClure's.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was them.
Tim? Must have been Tim.
It was Tim. Yeah, one of the McClure's, yeah.
He had
Tim,
a Volvo as well, and then he got into the bikes.
Hayabusa. Mm. And, yeah, Al and Tim's dad did race, I think it was a HQ in Super Street.
So that would be another third generation there as well.
Yeah, but
so.
I think they got him into it. I'm pretty sure
that might have been Al getting his father. Anyway, I digress a little bit there, but that's how I picture the group that's coming through now is the second generation.
So that would, based on that, then Casey would be third gen.
Yeah,
and Connor and
yeah, and Connor's Connor third and generation. Yeah, that's right. Yep, definitely. Yep. I want to ask you a question. If I flick through the Andrew rule book, I don't know, in the latest one, I haven't opened it up, but I probably should. But when I flick through the Andrew rule book, there's actually a picture of your car there.
Oh, yeah, okay. So that was probably the 2015, 2016
season.
Yeah,
possibly.
I believe that the photos there is the champion from the previous year.
Yep. How important is for Andrew to build the profile of modified?
Yeah, it's huge, and you want to be representing the sport in the best way you can, and like I said, for modified to have that options in the range of where you can then go with your drag racing, and even for not my car as because of the weight, but you know, there's been competitors that have been able to change their classes and change their group brackets to be able to go into a different competition and be playing a different game in drag racing. And so it just I feel as if it just gives so many options and so many opportunities to then continue in the sport and to explore the sport across those different groups and brackets. Mm-hmm. And would really just extend that, you know. Yeah. Like I said before, I got to a point where I was getting a bit too comfortable in the altered, and you know, we were thinking, you know, do we go supercharge outlaws? But because of the how light my chassis is, and it was just going to have to be a whole new deal for us, whole new engine. And,
Fair enough. Personally, so you're trained in automotive mechanics and auto body repair. How much of that is, if you want to be a successful drag racer, because in my mind, this is, well, money's one of them, but the other reason is I don't have the skills to build a car, maintain a car. Yeah. So how important is that background that you have in terms of racing?
I think it does depend on what class you're running. And it was really great. You know, my high school had a program that we were able to do our certificates in mechanics and automotive body repairs. And I was doing a lot of mechanics at home with my dad working on his trucks. My interest was really I loved cars. I loved working on cars. And I did look at pursuing a mechanical apprenticeship. I think at the time, you know, it was very repair the parts. It was replace the parts rather than repair, and that was the decision that really altered my decision of where I was going to go. In parts of me does regret that. I definitely don't know as much as I feel as if I used to. But then at the same time, my car doesn't often come apart, you know, because being in Group 3, working on your darlings, like my car has been the pure example of this season. I'm running slower than what I used to. I'm running, you know, I'm quite sure just on the weekend, you know, the 7.23 was quite possibly the quickest I've gone this season, and maybe even since my return with doing the last three meetings of last season. But when my car was going faster in the 7.10s and 7.0s, it was angry. It was, and I wasn't damaging the engine, but I was damaging the car. I was putting cracks in the exhaust pipes, cracks in my wheelie bars from tyre shakes.
Tyre shakes, horrible. You know,
mounts breaking off the car. But now almost like having the car running a bit slower, it's a bit tamer, but it's consistent. My car is slower and it's consistent and it's making me win, you know. So not having to really pull the car apart, I don't get as much learning, and I don't learn on that side as much. But in other classes, you know, they're pulling it down. They're pulling their engine part down or between rounds, if not at the end of the meeting. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I think the saying is with nitro, if you don't pull it apart every lap, it's going to pull itself apart on the next one.
But is that by virtue of your combination then, the 632, you're not leaning on it as hard?
Yeah.
Like I can imagine someone like Paul is LS-based. He's probably leaning on that a bit harder than what you're leaning on 632 maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I suppose like I've had Paul Ryan competing in his front engine dragster at the Western Nationals, and he top qualified, and that was my first time like not having that top qualifier position at Perth Motorplex. So there's always been quite a significant gap until where that second qualifier sits, that for a while it was just us wanting to improve my own PB, because in my first season I did 7.09 and a few years later did a 7.02, and we're like, oh, maybe we can do a 6, you know. Right. But I've never had to push the car for that competition aspect. You know, there are benefits of being in the higher qualifying position, and for me, having that 632 big block, it because of that engine size, it's come easy for me with that top qualifying.
Yeah.
I think that some of the times you were featured in the rule book was because you had the national record or had set the national record that year, because you did hold it. Do you still hold it now?
I don't hold it. I don't hold it anymore. I don't hold it. Kyle Putlin holds it for Perth.
Yeah.
But there are others that hold it for Sydney and Queensland. Yeah. But I had the track record for Perth. Perth, Sydney and Queensland, possibly even Adelaide, I suppose.
For years.
Adelaide International. But I'd have the certificate.
I don't think anyone was game enough to try to go faster.
yeah, there was definitely quite a gap between when the next qualifying was, but then in my bracket as well for the AMA, for where that's it for the record.
Yeah.
You spoke to me a couple of weeks ago about the Chicago shootout, and you sort of laid that out for me.
Yeah.
I know, Gonzo, I don't think you're a fan of this. Maybe can you explain to us how that all works with your qualifying? Because even though you explained it to me, when you speak about qualifying and top qualifying.
Thanks for throwing me under the bus.
Mate, it's just, for me, it's still for someone that doesn't go to the sport all the time, it's still like a bit of a mess, you know what I mean? How it works. Because for me, I'm like, well, if you want to top qualify, just go faster. You know what I mean? But it doesn't work like that, you know, with your, you know, how that setup is
for
these rounds.
Yes.
And maybe, Gons, you can come in and tell us why you don't like that.
Oh, look, I think there's plenty of people that don't like it. And for their own reasons why. And I think a lot of the time is that, you know, for Chicago Shootout, for the amount of entrants that we have at the moment, we've got three rounds. And so we have three rounds of racing, and it's best out of three goes into the final. And when you would see maybe someone that was, you know, your main contender in the points lose on their first round, if that was a knockout elimination round, and then you think, oh,
they're on the trailer.
They would have been out by now. You know, they would have been out, but they get a second chance, you know. For me personally, I do like the format. And the reason I like that is because it gives us more seat time and it gives us more nighttime racing. When the spectators are really coming in for the nighttime racing, you know, at the moment with the entrance that Modifiers had, we're likely just to have one round before the main crowd comes in. And a lot of the time the Motorplex is promoting it as like 5 p.m. and that's when the big show starts. But, you know, we would have our rounds earlier than that. And at the moment with three rounds of Chicago Shootout and then the finals being four all up, but I'd been in Modified when there was six, you know, it was six rounds of racing. And people come down and they say, oh, you're out already. And it's really disappointing, you know, and you really start to, you say, oh, come down earlier. But then you're like, oh, I really need to be able to make it through so I can stay there longer. The other aspect of it that I think it's got a huge benefit is that when we are going to be attracting and chasing sponsorship, to be able to guarantee I'm going to be on track minimum six times.
Yep.
Six times, fingers crossed for a seven. You're able to kind of get that, you know, you're able to sell that to them about that's when the crowd's going to be there and that's when your name is going to be on show on the car. And, so I like it for that aspect. But, look, you're definitely going to like it when it's working in your favour.
Yep.
And I think first three events of this season, I didn't lose around. I went into the finals coming off three round wins.
This goes back to your reason with the car being so consistent as well, not the need to go chase, you know, that bit extra, because you can still, obviously you've got that three rounds to, you know, to win or to you're going to have that time anyway.
Yeah, I
is that a part of the reason why not having to sort of always sort of go wilder on the car and just have it nice and consistent for that format?
Yeah.
Does it go hand in hand?
I'm not sure whether it would go. It would make people want to go faster having that.
Yeah.
For me, I personally think that it helps me more in the mentality and the mental side of racing. And I think for elimination round format, you know, the fact that you can just be on the trailer after the first round, there's a lot of pressure on there. I almost feel as if I have less pressure going into a Chicago shootout format, knowing that you still are going to be running throughout the night. And I think that's because, for me, winning's great. You know, winning's great, but, and Trent, you know, I've told him this before, and for me personally, winning's the cherry on top. I think for me personally, I want to win for other people's benefit. Mm-hmm. For me, I really enjoy just being on track and having the support of my spectators and my girls. But, you know, I don't know if you've seen much, but I come down that return road and all the kids, they just run to the fence. And
that's cool.
And I feel like a celebrity, you know. And so for me, I want to be racing. You want to be racing to win, but having that opportunity to still be out on track, showing your car, waving to the fans, having them still come down to the track, sit in the car. When are you going to be out next? Yep, 7:30, make sure you're watching. You know, your night doesn't end, and I think what you're getting out of racing, and for me, let's be honest, we're not coming out on top when it comes to prize money, when it comes to you know, we're getting through. So you want to be getting more
some value
out of it.
Yeah,
it needs to mean more to you than that. And for me, the spectators is really what drives my passion for it. Yeah.
Mm. So tell me, pretend I'm a 15-year-old girl. I'm listening to this podcast right now.
I'm struggling with this, Nick.
What I want to know what your message is to that 10 to 26-year-old, we'll say, female audience.
Yeah, look, I think to get involved, I think a lot of people, and like we said before, so many of our racers are that second generation, or they've got someone that they have been affiliated with, and whether it be a brother or a girlfriend or a brother or a partner or a parent that's been racing.
It might be a girlfriend.
It might be a girlfriend, you know. it's definitely, I think it's that sport where it's much easier to get involved when you know someone, where you can be a part of it, where you can kind of get behind the scenes. But so many people are actually happy and willing to let you do that. So if it's something that they want to do, if it's something that they're interested in doing, and if they don't have a direct line of family member or friends already that they can then join and get experience from, you know, come and ask.
Yeah.
Because there'll be plenty of people that would be willing to take them under their wing and show them the sport and encourage them to get involved, yeah.
I agree 100%.
Speak with Liz Johns.
She'd
be a good starting point.
I think wouldn't be a team down there that wouldn't
exactly
want another crew member. And, you know, I think that's the great thing about drag racing is that most of us do want to teach other people about it, because when you understand it, it's so much more than what it appears to be on the surface.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing sport.
Yeah. Mm. I think where it gets a little bit stuck there is our restrictions on our crew bands. You know, for me, I get three crew bands, and now with my husband Trent, my father-in-law Trevor, and my nephew Ethan. Ethan drives the tow car, but there is no way he's not getting an armband. You know, he's working on the car. Does he have to be standing on track when I'm running? No, but I want him to have that benefit of being able to go on the track, stand in the crew-allocated spectator boxes that are on the start. But it does then make it harder to have more people involved. And, you know, for me, when Trent returns to racing, I'm going to be two crew members down. And you want to be able to educate and bring someone else on, and you kind of have to be on track to do that.
You know? So you're given three. You're not you're not allowed to purchase anymore, or that's just
not the armbands. No. That's yeah. just not
yeah.
on track. Not
so so on track. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I see a lot more people. Is it different categories or
yeah? In Door Slammer, I think you're allowed five. Yeah, yeah. Five.
Is it five? Or
yeah,
four?
I'm pretty sure. In Door Slammer, I'm almost positive it's five.
Five.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, so it just makes it difficult. You know, sometimes I'm not even sure if it's something that they still do, but sometimes you could get an extra one for your reverse gear, you know. But whether they still do that, I think it's something that they really need to be taking into consideration now, particularly for the promotion of the sport and where social media is. You know, I've been saying to Trent, like, oh, you got to take some photos. I mean, definitely. It's hard enough to get him to take photos of me and the kids, let alone take some photos of me on the track, right?
I think social media, it doesn't matter what you're doing, if you're business, sport, whatever, you just need to be on. It's just another part of that business, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, your crew want to be watching the car, and they're watching the tyres, they're watching the launch. They're actually, like, peeking through gaps in the fiberglass body and watching what my hands are doing. And they don't want to be looking through a camera or looking through your phone. No. I'd love to be able to open it up, to be able to bring more of that in, because there's whole roles and there's careers in the NHRA of these social media marketing, yeah. And they're allocated across different teams to be able to capture that.
Sorry, Nick. You ran this accent, but yeah. I'm just because I always look for jobs for my daughter to do. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And that's a perfect example. Yeah. Just someone, even just not maybe totally interested in the sport, you know, but is interested in the media side of things and your socials and your reels and all that sort of stuff. You don't need to, but that's, you can start there, you know. Mm. That's another way to get into it and be in the media.
Yeah.
Do you think that's where Radio versus the World gets its popularity from? Like, we have, like, we go to the opposite way there. It's like there's 300 people on the start line.
But this is what I was saying to you. That's what I was I didn't want to mention radio. I didn't want to get in trouble, but yeah.
No, but really, radio versus the world. Like, see, there's, honestly, there'd be not 300, but there would be close to 100 on the start line.
Yeah, but that's a Southern American thing.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And I mean, but is that something I don't know?
Is it safe? Is what you're supposed to be asking right now.
I don't know if that's something. Yeah, I think there's got to be obviously somewhere in between, clearly.
The reason they cut it back was because it was getting ridiculous like that at one stage. But, you know, whether that was the right decision or not, I think if they just had said, listen, you're not with this team, piss off.
Yeah.
You know, because if you look at some of that old footage from the early to mid 2000s, there were times there where it was like 30 people on the start line. It's like, it's only five in each team.
But it's tight now. There's no one down on the moment. It's really tight now.
They're very strict
now. But I think, and more respectful as well. I think crew, once the car's gone, they're out of there. You know, they're quickly out of there and the next sort of crew come in. So
it's not as many teams too, you know. Like,
yeah.
You know, that number's coming back.
Yeah.
I think if things keep going the way they're going, and the energy that you feel down there this season is totally different than it has been for the last five seasons. Everyone's happier. Everyone's getting along with each other. There's not as much bickering as there used to be. And, you know, people that I deal with are seeing that and going, oh, you know, I might dust the car off and bring it back. And that's what we need more. Because I believe that for every racer, there is 100 people in that crowd, you know, because there's usually about 10 people that you know, and then they tell another 10 people, and the next meeting you've got that extra 100 people, and that can blow out to 1,000 people in some instances, because, you know, you start, oh, I went down, it was great, you know, this happened, that happened. People start talking about it. We talk about it in marketing as the water cooler discussions, you know.
Yeah.
Now, I know social media has taken a big chunk of that away, and there's probably more potential for propagation through social media, but a lot of the people that were our core group, they're not really the social media people, the older ones that walked away for a while, I see more of them coming back.
Yeah.
Vince Belladonna's a perfect example of that. I reckon at the Western Nationals, although not on his team or in his crew, he would have personally had, I don't know, 35 to 40 people come down for him.
But you know what, Nick? You would be shocked how many people come into my workshop, and as soon as they see Vince's photo, they go, I know that guy.
Yeah.
Would we be shocked? It actually doesn't surprise me.
He's just a very, very well-liked and well-supported race. And when he wins, you know, a lot of people are cheering for him in the crowd.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's something that I noticed at the Westerns, was that there was more people cheering for races.
It was phenomenal this year. This was really, really noticeable. I don't know if it was the Kyle Putland effect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not sure, but there was...
I think things are just getting better and better.
Yeah.
I really see some light at the end of the tunnel. We had a rough 4 or 5 years there.
Yeah. And look, there was times where we did think about returning to racing, but Modified had 3 entrants.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, okay, are we doing this to be in a competition that only has 3 others? And... a lot of people park their cars, and it almost seems like, you know, once a few start creeping back, it's like, oh, okay, yep, the competition's getting bigger, and you don't, for us personally, you know, we didn't want to make those sacrifices in other areas to be racing in a competition that was only against 3 other cars.
And it's hard with the kids too, because you kind of feel as though you know, they're missing out on something because you're doing something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a really hard balancing act.
My mind's definitely been in that stage at the moment, and because Luna had a birthday party on Saturday and I was fortunate enough to be able to get someone to take her there, and then my mum come down to the track. But it's not actually getting her to the party, it's then bringing her to the track afterwards. And of course, like, you want her involved, she wants to be involved, she doesn't want to miss out. But also at the stage where you start to think about what their activities are going to be, and when it is, you know, the 10-year age restriction for when they can start juniors, it's almost like, do I have to just make sure that my girls are choosing winter sports, because I'm not going to be able to take them
that's
on
gold.
A Saturday when...
I'm going to tell my wife that one.
Just winter sports only. Well, the go-karting, you know, they only stop for 2 months.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so I'm like, do I get her into go-karts? But and that's where, like I said, you know, friends with the Priolos, David stepped out because Cruz is doing great with go-karting.
Yeah.
And
it
was... copping a few speeding fines, I think, getting from Wanneroo Barbagallo down to the motorplex to then make it in time for hot laps at 5 o'clock.
Michelle, where can we find more information? I know you've got a magnificent looking website, by the way.
Where
can we find more information about yourself? I know Facebook, Instagram, tell us all the socials.
Yeah, that's right. Like, definitely trying to build up the socials. It does get hard, but it's how we get the message across, I suppose, and how we're able to communicate with everyone about what's happening and when racing is on. I really wanted to kind of have a bit to... go off for this season before really heavily promoting myself. I didn't want to be just quoting back to what I did 7 years ago.
You won on the weekend.
Yeah, you know, but I feel like now I'm in a good position to be able to say that, like, I'm still there.
I'm pretty sure you are.
And so I didn't want to be coming in this season and trying to get sponsors saying, you know, 7 years ago I did this and 7 years ago I did that. I wanted to have something relevant under my belt to say where I am now. I'll be pushing that hard for the next season. But
So what's the web address?
Yeah, www.michellemorrisonmotorsport.com.au.
And on Facebook as well?
On Facebook as well and Instagram, yep.
Michelle, it's been a pleasure having
you
on.
Much.
It's been really great. I really enjoyed it. And look, that was really insightful what you told us at the start. Never thought that, never considered that. So I'm really glad you told us that, actually. And that's what the podcast is all about. Yes. And, Johnny, thank you for organising it as well.
Oh. This man. No problem. It's a pleasure. I see her every Saturday at the cafe after a training session, her and Trent and the girls. It's always a pleasure seeing them every Saturday morning.
Yeah, no, and that's what the podcast is all about. I mean, we are a motorsport podcast, but, you know, I have to be honest, the heart has always been with drag racing, and I know, obviously, with him as well. That's where our passion is. Yeah, I like supercars. Yeah, I like Formula One.
Well, Ferrari won.
Yeah, but I've always, drag racing for me is where it's at, because of those things. You know, you talked about that earlier, you know, like the girls, you know, sleeping in the car when you're on the track. What better environment for those kids, you know, and when people say that's not right, they don't understand. Yeah. They've never enjoyed the family environment that this sport offers us. Yeah. And that's the one thing that you might not be family, but when you're down there, you're family.
Yeah, and I think something huge that we need to take into consideration as well, drag racing allowing spectators to enter the pits.
Yeah.
You know, and
accessibility.
Yeah, and they can really get up close and personal as well with the drivers, with the cars, and often be able to get a seat in the car as well. So.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Yeah, all the kids get to sit in most cars these days. So, yeah.
Yeah, and adults, you know, for me, I had quite a few on my list for who gave me the opportunity to sit in their car and even I did a start-up in Stuart Bishop's Camaro when he was...
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
The diamond car.
Yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't you love to see that back on?
That'd be awesome, yeah. Yeah. The diamond car. That's right.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Was it? Yeah. Hey, that's a flashback.
The real diamond. The real diamond. Yeah.
That was a fast car too.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Michelle, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure having you on. You can catch us at talkandpower.com.au or find us on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us.